from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today, the state Democratic Assembly minority leader shares why she's hopeful for more bipartisanship in the legislature. Then we'll explore the Wisconsin Policy Forum's top findings from 2024, including how home prices are outpacing wage increases in the state.
We found that the median sale price of homes in Wisconsin during that period from 2017 to 2022 had increased by more than 50%, by about 53% in just a five-year period.
Plus, we'll speak with a Wisconsin producer of the Oscar-winning documentary short film, The Last Repair Shop.
It's always the most beautiful thing about being on a film set is like you have this big group of people and they're all collectively using of their time and talents towards a singular purpose. And I've never felt it more than in that moment.
All of that is coming up on Lake Effect. But first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers, and thank you so much for joining us. A new legislative cycle has kicked off in the Wisconsin Capitol. WUWM is checking in with legislators to hear about their goals for this term. To learn what's ahead in 2025, WUWM's Mayan Silver spoke with Greta Neubauer, a Democratic state representative from Racine and the Assembly Minority Leader.
I'd like to ask you, first of all, what would you say communicating across the aisle has looked like in past sessions?
It's been extremely difficult to do bipartisan work because of the very extreme gerrymander that we had in Wisconsin for over a decade. The gerrymander really meant that Republicans were almost guaranteed majorities in both the Assembly and the Senate, and it meant that they really didn't need to work across the aisle or to listen to dissenting voices in their own districts. But we now have new legislative maps, and they are very competitive. There are a lot of members of the Assembly and Senate, both Democrats and Republicans, who are in very close seats, and they need to be responsive to their constituents. And I hope that that is going to really change the dynamics in the state legislature going forward.
You know, in the Assembly, Democrats added 10 seats. I know you also talked at a session preview for WisPolitics about how a lot of legislators are now in seats that are up for grabs that aren't so certain for their particular side one way or the other. So you kind of made the case that people have to be more responsive to the electorate. Are you seeing that kind of thing happening so far? Like, do you have any examples of it?
Yeah, so we're just getting started, of course. We had inauguration here on Monday, January 6th, and representatives and senators are moving into their offices and starting to get to work on policy. I think what we've seen so far is that Speaker Voss would like things to continue as they have before. They haven't expressed a lot of priorities for the coming session, really tax cuts being the only thing they've communicated, and even going so far as to threaten not to pass a budget if Governor Evers weren't to agree to their tax cut proposal, which will most likely benefit the wealthiest Wisconsinites the most. So we're seeing some of the same intention to block important policy on things like education and investment in education, or addressing clean drinking water, investing in education. But we also, again, have a lot of new members who are coming in very close seats. We have Republican incumbents who just ran in elections that they barely won in some cases, right? A few hundred to a few thousand votes. And my hope and expectation is that those members will go to their leadership and say, listen, I really need to see investment in education. My district is going to referendum again. We do not want to raise our local property taxes. We have a $4 billion surplus. What can we do for our schools? So we will see how things go. We really are just getting started, but I am hopeful that the membership will push their leadership to engage with Democrats, to pass bipartisan policy, and to listen to the people of Wisconsin, because that's what they sent us here to do.
And you've mentioned a few of those Democratic priorities. I guess, in a nutshell, what are Democrats' biggest priorities this year? And if you could break down what, as you know, you've mentioned GOP Assembly Speaker Robin Voss, he likes to call it a wish list on the part of the Democrats and Governor Evers a lot of the time. What do you think you'll actually be able to get done out of the things that you want to get done?
Sure. So I would say there are really two priorities that rise to the top for our caucus. The first is addressing costs for working families. We all are coming back from the campaign trail, Democrats and Republicans alike, right? Many of us knocking on the same doors of the same voters over the last 6 months. And we heard a lot about how people are struggling to afford housing, whether that's buying a home or their rent, groceries, of course, childcare, prescription drugs. There are things we can do here in Madison to help people make ends meet. And we are really hoping that we're going to have productive conversations on particularly childcare. We're going to face another cliff here in Wisconsin as federal funds run out this year. Housing, how can we increase the availability of those, they're called starter homes, right? Those homes that are a reasonable price for a family who's just getting started in the market. And then prescription drugs. There's more that we can do to provide oversight, make sure that we don't have bad actors in this space or in grocery prices. We've all heard about shrinkflation. Some of these issues are federal, but some of them can be addressed at the state. And so I'm really hoping that we will see some more engagement from Republican legislators on this. And I do think that's possible. Again, they were out talking to the same people we were in our communities, and we all heard about challenges with rising costs. And then education. Many districts across the state, my own in Racine County among them, have gone to referendum repeatedly in the last several years or are planning to do so in the years ahead just to continue with their current operations, right? We don't have school districts who are making new investments in most cases. We really just have districts that are passing referendums so that they don't have to cut teachers, cut programs, job training. We need to be investing in the safety and security of our schools. So we hope that we will see representatives from across both political parties rally around public education in Wisconsin. And it will certainly be at the top of our list for this budget session.
You did mention tax cuts. Voss issued a press release talking about how he's tried to limit the growth of government and pass meaningful, in his words, meaningful tax relief. Those were his priorities. Obviously, both Democrats and Republicans have to work on the budget. Governor Evers drafts his version. The Joint Finance Committee will look at that and take up their version. And, there has to be inherently some negotiation with that. What are you expecting during that process?
Yeah, so we are very open to conversations about a tax cut. Again, we do know that there are many people in Wisconsin who are struggling to make ends meet. But what we're not interested in is a tax cut that really benefits the wealthiest Wisconsinites or corporations. And we've seen a lot of that from Republicans over the last few years. Tax cut proposals that are not aimed at putting dollars back in the pockets of the people who really need them, but where the majority of the benefit does go to people who are already doing okay. And so we will see what Republicans propose this year. And I'm sure there will be quite a bit of back and forth about a tax cut. But we are always open to conversations about tax cuts that are focused on those middle and working class families.
Do you have any comment on the Government Oversight, Accountability, and Transparency Committee, aka GOAT, that Speaker Voss created in line with Trump's Department of Government Efficiency?
Mm-hmm. So we already have a number of committees here in the state legislature that look at operations of government, audit, of course, being among them. And many committees, colleges and universities, right, playing sort of an oversight role for the UW system. We will be interested to see the approach of the chair of this committee. I think the way that the Assembly Democrats feel is that we believe that government should be efficient and we believe government should be accountable and transparent. But I hope that this committee is not used as an attack on government and on services. We know that it's the state provides essential services to the people of Wisconsin, and we want those to be well run. And we are always open to conversations about how we can better serve the people of the state, but we aren't interested in partisan attacks on agencies or the UW system or our public schools that, again, are driven by Trump and Elon Musk and an effort to undermine the provision of services.
You also talked about the $4.6 billion surplus. Wisconsin is actually in pretty good financial shape compared to a lot of other states this year, but I think you're still waiting to hear from the Legislative Fiscal Bureau to have a report about whether a lot, like some of that is one-time money or whether it's part of money the state will continue to receive. Do you and other Democratic leaders have plans for what they'd like to do with that money?
Yeah, so we know that there are important investments we need to make through this budget. Our Republican colleagues have been talking about the importance of making sure that we are financially sound for the long term, and we couldn't agree more, which is why we cannot pass really large tax cuts that benefit the wealthiest Wisconsinites like our Republican colleagues have been proposing for the past several sessions. So we are interested in making essential investments in our local communities. We can invest on a one-time basis in infrastructure for our roads and bridges and public transit. We can invest in education. We can invest in local governments and housing. There's a lot of good that we can do with that surplus while also making sure that we are being responsible long term and not overcommitting the state based on the resources that we bring in.
And finally, how would you put that state policy interacts with what's happening in the federal government? Obviously, Republican Donald Trump is now president again. How much will his administration's policy affect what's happening in the Wisconsin legislature?
Well, we're all in a bit of wait and see mode. We know that Republicans have laid out some plans in Project 2025 and through the Trump campaign to really attack and undermine the well-being of Wisconsinites. I would say that we are certainly watching closely on reproductive rights, ensuring that Wisconsinites' freedoms will be protected and that we're doing everything we can. We know that there are going to be efforts to undermine public education at the federal level, and so want to make sure we're doing what's necessary to support our students here in Wisconsin to get a great education at every level. We know that Trump continues to have, you know, xenophobic, transphobic, homophobic comments. And of course, we anticipate further attacks on undocumented Wisconsinites and the LGBTQ community. And so we're going to be doing everything we can to make Wisconsin a safe place for folks to live that has a strong economy and great opportunities for people to live and raise a family.
Are there any specific examples that you have on that, or is it just too early to say? And also, how would you communicate with Republicans about these topics?
Well, we're always looking to find ways to reach across the aisle to serve our constituents. And so I think on, for example, the proposal by the Trump administration to conduct mass deportations, we know that the dairy industry in Wisconsin is absolutely reliant on undocumented employees. We have seen estimates of, you know, 70% of those working in the dairy industry are undocumented. I hope that we can collectively understand that mass deportations would have a really negative impact on the Wisconsin economy and very likely collapse the dairy industry here. You know, it remains to be seen exactly how far Donald Trump will take these proposals, but we're certainly in conversations with partners about legislation that could be passed here to protect our reproductive rights and to ensure that LGBTQ people are welcome in Wisconsin.
All right, Assembly Minority Leader Greta Neubauer, thanks for speaking to us at WWM.
Thank you. Appreciate it, Mayan.
Greta Neubauer is a Democratic state representative from Racine and the Assembly Minority Leader. She spoke with WUWM's Mayan Silver. And did you know you can listen to Lake Effect as a podcast? Search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcasts to download and listen on demand. In about 15 minutes, we'll speak with a Wisconsin native who won an Oscar last year. But first, we'll look at some of the most interesting things that happened in Wisconsin policy in 2024. That's coming up on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. As we set off into a new year, many of us are looking back at the year that was 2024. That includes the Wisconsin Policy Forum, an organization that analyzes critical policy issues in the state of Wisconsin. They compiled a list of their top five findings of the year, and the forum's communications director, Mark Sommerhauser, joins me now to share it. Mark, thank you so much for joining us once again on Lake Effect.
It's great to be with you.
The first finding we're going to look at, I don't think it's going to be surprising for many people, especially if you have bought a home recently. The finding was that since 2017, home prices have far outpaced incomes in Wisconsin, making home buying more daunting. What does that breakdown look like?
Yeah, so I think you're right that that finding is not going to shock anybody who's even spent any time on Zillow recently. We looked at the median sale price of homes in Wisconsin during a period from 2017 through 2022. At that point, that was early last year, so that was the most recent data we had was 2022. And we found that the median sale price of homes in Wisconsin during that period from 2017 to 2022 had increased by more than 50%, by about 53% in just a five-year period, from about $173,000 for a median home price in 2017 up to about $265,000 just 5 years later. For comparison, during that same period of time, the median household income in the state of Wisconsin did increase, but it increased only by about 19.7%, you know, much less than that median home sale price.
So harder for a lot of Wisconsinites to get a home than it would have been 5 years earlier.
Yes, that's correct. So One way to think about this and one sort of metric that you will hear folks talk about in this space is the home price to income ratio for a household. That obviously can vary in terms of what we think about as being a sort of acceptable threshold, but the sort of general shorthand that you'll hear a lot of folks in real estate and other those related industries talk about is that generally speaking, a home buyer can afford to spend roughly 2.6 times their household income on a home. Prior to the Great Recession, our price-to-income ratio was relatively high, historically speaking. It was a little above 3. It dropped quite a bit during the Great Recession, down to a low of about 2.6 in 2011. And then it started ticking back upward, and it hit its highest point in at least 15 years. In 2022, it was up to 3.7, so well above that affordability threshold of 2.6.
Mm. Now, moving to the next finding. This is really looking at healthcare. Wisconsin is one of just 10 states that hasn't fully expanded Medicaid. And the forum's research found that it's actually the only one of those states that would have substantial savings by doing so. How substantial are we talking here?
Yeah, I think one of the challenges with this debate is that it often gets nationalized. The Affordable Care Act, federal laws, and federal programs. The reality is that the implications are very different from state to state. Each state has to make its own decision under the Affordable Care Act, whether it wants to expand Medicaid. And the financial ramifications of that are very different from one state to another, based on a whole lot of factors that we talk about in our report. But the real eye-opening finding that we came across in our report last year was that there are 10 states now that have not expanded Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act. One thing to keep in mind for the other 9 states is that they would actually have to pay out more from state coffers in order to expand Medicaid. Now, there, of course, would be benefits for their state's residents in doing so. More of them would have health coverage, but state government in those other 9 states would actually have to pay more money in order to move ahead with that Medicaid expansion. Wisconsin is the only state where that is actually not the case and where it is actually the opposite scenario here in Wisconsin. If we were to expand Medicaid under the ACA, we would lower our ongoing state Medicaid spending by more than $500 million over the 2-year budget cycle, about $260 million per year, in addition to, you know, the expansion in coverage and some of these other factors, as well as some additional upfront federal funding that the state would receive on a one-time basis if we were to expand Medicaid. So a lot of times this gets kind of nationalized, but we found it helpful to kind of compare the circumstances for our state to the other 9 states, and we found a pretty different picture here in Wisconsin.
Mm. So we're talking about a situation where we would be spending less money, or we would be getting more money back in our pocket and likely more people covered for health insurance. To me, it sounds like a win-win situation. What so far has been the rationale for not expanding Medicaid?
Yeah, I think initially some folks in the legislature who were opposed to expansion, this was kind of in the early period in the years following the enactment of the Affordable Care Act, there was a concern that it might be repealed, that the federal funding that the ACA provides to expand Medicaid would be possibly pulled back. Now, of course, we're, 14, almost 15 years after the passage of the ACA. It has not yet been repealed. So I think in the minds of some people, that concern is less compelling than it might have been, say, in 2013 or 2014. There is also a concern from our state's healthcare providers. They really have not taken a position of being either for or against expansion necessarily, but there is some concern about the reimbursement rates under Medicaid, which are quite low, especially here in Wisconsin. The rate at which we reimburse providers to treat people who are on Medicaid is quite low. It's much lower than most providers receive to treat somebody who's on private health insurance. And so I think the concern that you hear from some providers is that there could be some folks, they might have care through one of these ACA marketplaces, that they might now, if we were to expand Medicaid, be shifting onto Medicaid, and then their providers would receive a lower reimbursement rate to treat them. So that's one of the big issues that has been kind of a sticking point in this whole discussion.
So looking at one of the other findings, this next one sounds both good and bad. State and local taxes fell to record lows in 2022, well below the national average. What is that tax burden looking like here?
Yeah, so this was really an eye-opening finding, and I think was one of our findings in 2024 that certainly generated the most interest and got the most attention. So if we take all those state and local taxes as a share of personal income, they were at 9.9%, and that was a drop from the year before, and it was a really significant drop from what it has been previously in Wisconsin. We call this measure the state's tax burden, and it has fallen both relative to itself and relative to other states. And I think the state's ranking is significant because it often comes up in a lot of discussions about state taxation. There's a lot of concern, I would say, especially among fiscal conservatives, but even among some folks of differing ideologies about if the state is perceived to have really high taxes compared to other states, that can be, in some people's minds, a real disadvantage in terms of economic development. And especially for some of your kind of older listeners, they'll recall in the not that distant past, Wisconsin was a very high tax state. In fact, as recently as 2000, Wisconsin ranked 3rd among the 50 states for tax burden. And just in the last 24 years here, we've seen quite a dramatic shift. And in 2022, we had fallen all the way to 35th in our tax burden rank. That was by far the lowest on record. So this notion of Wisconsin being a high tax state, which was quite accurate not that long ago, has really been upended here over the last 2 decades.
With taxes in mind, the forum's research also found that MPS leaders more than tripled the district's property tax levy for recreation in 23 to 24. They then lowered it again this year. Why did it raise so sharply and then drop down again?
Right. So this was one that we kind of flagged more because it just there was not a lot of attention or public discussion about this increase prior to when it happened. And there are a lot of circumstances that went into the board's decision to do what it did. But this was last year, last fall, while the MPS board was considering the district's final budget for 2024, the board voted to increase a specific tax levy for a fund that most people, even probably even people who know a lot about MPS may not know about, but it's called Fund 80. It's the district's community service fund. And it's a special fund that actually goes for non-classroom activities that are outside of school hours, and many of which actually don't even serve students. They serve the entire community, things like adult education and recreation and things of that nature. The district did, as you said, voted to increase the levy for that Fund 80 very sharply from $34.7 million to more than $112 million in 2024. And it was really a response to a sort of unexpected finding that the district had made that the levy, the district's main levy to support school operations, which is by far a much larger property tax levy to actually support the ongoing operations of its many schools, was going to be far lower than was anticipated due to some changes that had been made in the state budget in 2023, which was enacted in July of 2023. And so that's why some of those changes were only becoming apparent to the board kind of in the weeks and months prior to this vote. Of course, we have had another budget now a year later. The district did subsequently lower that amount for that Fund 80 levy, but there was, you know, that really significant increase. Since that time, we have a little more clarity, I would say, as well, on where those additional funds are going to be directed toward within Fund 80. The district has said it's going to, the dollars are going to be used to fund a new recreation community center and aquatic facility at the former Browning School and Browning Playfield location.
Now, the final finding we'll look at, it's another one that sounds both good and bad. Arrests by the Milwaukee Police Department fell by more than 82% over the past decade. On the one hand, that sounds like fewer crimes are happening. On the other hand, it sounds like Milwaukee police may not be pursuing criminals enough or as much as they were previously. Can you unpack what you found there?
Yes. So, you know, the way you kind of set it up there is fair. To give a quick rundown of the data, what we found there was arrests by the Milwaukee Police Department fell by about 82% over the past decade from 2012 through 2023. I think a lot of your listeners are probably aware that there was a lot happening with public safety during the pandemic. Nationally and in Milwaukee, we saw this pretty significant increase in crime in 2020 and 2021, and before it actually did decline kind of in the years since. But the thing to understand about this trend with arrests by MPD is that this was happening before, during, and after the pandemic. So not to say that there was no interplay with the pandemic, but it's pretty clear that there was a lot of things that were happening independent of the pandemic as well that were affecting this. I should say, too, that there's all these other metrics that we looked at that really kind of tell a similar story. Police contacts with citizens saw a very sharp decline. Traffic stops saw a very sharp decline. Kind of painting a similar picture here. And as you said, there's a lot of different potential reasons for this. We know in the last few years, especially, that crime really has gone down. And so is there a link between arrests and crime? Potentially, but that number can also tell you potentially something about how the department is going about policing and how proactive they're being. We wanted some context because, again, there's been a whole lot of, frankly, kind of crazy stuff happening with public safety in the last few years. So we wanted to kind of ground this in comparison with peer cities. And what we found was that at the beginning of the period we were studying, in 2012, Milwaukee actually had the highest arrest rate per capita of any of the cities that we looked at. And these were cities of similar size to Milwaukee and kind of somewhat similar circumstances. By 2023, our arrest rate had declined quite markedly, both in total raw numbers and a per capita basis. And by that point, we were the third lowest among the 12 cities that we looked at. So it does tell us that maybe at the beginning of this period, we were very much on the high end for arrests. And now we've seen such a sharp decline that we're very much on the low end. There are a ton of factors that go into how many individuals are arrested by Milwaukee police, you know, in a city of 600,000 people. And it's difficult to really isolate one or even two or three. A few of the factors that we were able to identify was the fact that, again, in the most recent few years, there has been, I think, a decline in reported offenses. There's been declines in staffing levels at Milwaukee Police Department, and you probably have reported on some of the efforts that MPD has made to recruit, because they're really having difficulty filling all the open positions that they have. There has been some significant changes over the last decade in MPD leadership and in the philosophy of some of the folks that have led the department, which we go into a little more in the report that I think probably had an impact. And then there's also this legal settlement that the MPD entered into back in, I believe, 2018, called the Collins Settlement. This was reached after the department was sued over its stop and frisk practices. And the settlement required MPD to record a lot more data and provide more justification for traffic stops, field interviews, other encounters with citizens that officers would make. And we do think that there's a great deal of evidence that that has contributed to the decline in traffic stops and arrests as well. So these are all factors, and there could be certainly some more factors, but these are some of the things that we think go into those declines.
Sure. I will say, looking at your data, starting in 2012, it looked like Milwaukee was a major outlier as far as our peer cities that we were being judged against. But as you say, we're on the lower end, but it does feel like now we're more in keeping with kind of the average.
Yeah, I mean, I would say a little below actually now, but the context to me was very helpful in that we were somewhat of an outlier. I think that's fair to say in 2012 in terms of being very much on the high end. And we just have seen a really, really significant shift in the last 11 years.
Yeah. Well, Mark, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing your work. And I'm looking forward to what's to come in 2025.
Same here. We're excited to keep, you know, putting out a lot more research, and always appreciate getting a chance to discuss it with you.
Mark Sommerhauser is the Communications Director for the Wisconsin Policy Forum. Coming up, we'll tell you about the Oscar-winning short documentary, The Last Repair Shop, which celebrates the devoted craftspeople that repair students' musical instruments. That's next on Lake Effect, on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. Last year, a Wisconsin native and UW-Milwaukee alum took home his second Oscar. Josh Rosenberg is from Green Bay, studied broadcast journalism, and even interned here at WUWM before he went on to build his career in filmmaking. Today, Rosenberg is the EVP of production at Breakwater Studios and was one of the producers of the documentary short film, The Last Repair Shop. It's a story about a few devoted craftspeople that maintain over 80,000 musical instruments for students across Los Angeles public schools. Rosenberg joined WUWM's Lena Tran and Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski after his win to talk about the film.
Before we get to the film, you interned here at our station for a time in 2005 to 2006, and apparently that experience led you in the direction of film and far away from radio. So how did you discover film was your calling?
Well, you know, I've always been interested in telling stories. I was lucky enough in high school. We had access to cameras and Final Cut Pro, and so I was able to kind of get into stories in that way. And then, you know, I love the long form storytelling that journalism offers, and, you know, actually did get to do some slightly longer stuff when I was at Milwaukee Public Radio. And, you know, it's just been this journey of like trying to find the best avenue to tell the right stories. And it's like every story is going to have, you know, the right length for it, the right medium for it. And, you know, throughout my career, I've just have been able to work my way through different, you know, I've done some stuff in narrative. I worked for Oprah Winfrey's company in Chicago and LA for a while, and found my way to Breakwater, where we are very passionate about telling these humanistic short documentaries. And we just feel like it's a space that is really, it's an untapped resource. And so we're just pouring all the tools of cinema into really trying to expand the audience base and create these stories that really couldn't live anywhere else but in the short doc.
You mentioned you got to do some long-form journalism. What did you all do when you were here at our station?
So, you know, as an intern, it's like, it's really is like, there's certain things that like are just the day-to-day stuff that you have to do. But I got to do a golf story that was fun with, and I got, of course, now, you know, this is 14 years later or more. I can't remember her name, but, she was coming up the ranks as a professional golfer. And so got to do a profile piece on her. So that was a lot of fun, but yeah, it was an enjoyable experience.
That's so cool. Well, you know, a natural path for anyone that has an internship at WWM, go on and win an Oscar. Tell us what your work on The Last Repair Shop looked like.
So it's interesting, you know, so this was an original project that Breakwater Studios, who I work for, fully self-funded. And so a lot of times these projects just have a long life cycle on them. So we started actually shooting this film back in 2019. You know, and it's kind of one of those where it's like you get enough money to go do another shoot and then another shoot. So we were just kind of piecing it together. And so over that time horizon, I was the only producer that stayed on the project throughout the entirety of it. And so, you know, a lot of it is like keeping momentum for the project. And like, you know, we had a lot of different changes. We did the original interview with the repair people. And then Chris Bowers, who's one of our co-directors on the film, was like, we need to have the kids. There's something missing about the kids. And then, you know, we found all these amazing kids that we ended up getting to film with. And then, you know, you saw a number of them in the film. You know, Porsche, who's the young girl who went up on stage with Chris and Ben at the Oscars. And so, you know, a lot of it is just like finding what the story needs and then trying to facilitate what Ben and Chris need as the directors. And then the last bit, which was so much fun, was the end credit sequence. We filmed that just last year at the Eastwood stage at Warner Brothers, which, like, you know, the history of that room, you know, so many amazing scores have been filmed there. And we had a 60-person orchestra. It was just like such a huge lift from the production team. I have a bunch of great producers that I work with. You know, it really was a team effort. But it was such a beautiful moment of having this room filled with LAUSD alums all playing the music that the audience gets to hear. And I think, you know, as you having seen the film, could feel how impactful that was to, like, because it really is the fruits of those labors, right? And I think a lot of times in education, you do the work and you think you know the impact that you're having, but you don't get it reflected back to you. And so that was the one thing that was just like so impactful for our storytellers, the repair folks in this, was like just getting what they mean to the community reflected back to them. And so that was really, really special for us as filmmakers to get to see that through their eyes.
To go back to the students, so the Los Angeles School District provides freely repaired musical instruments to students, and it's one of the last cities in America to do so. And as you mentioned, you kind of would start, stop filming, collecting some material over the years. But when it came to selecting students and getting these voices with so many possibilities, how did you decide which students to highlight?
So Chris Bowers, who's one of the co-directors of the film, he went to LAUSD, and so he has a connection to that community still. And he went to high school at a place called the Colburn School, which is like a music first high school experience for students. And so they were incredible. So that we actually filmed at the Colburn School for this. And so they were able, with Chris's connections in LAUSD and the Colburn School, we were able to kind of partner together to find all of those different voices. And we ended up interviewing a bunch of kids. You know, oftentimes it's like, this is maybe the first time they've ever been interviewed before. And so, you know, we interviewed a bunch of kids, and just there were certain kids that just stood out, whether it was just their personality or their connection with Chris and Ben during the interview, you know, and then those tended to be the ones that we focused more on it for the actual film.
Yeah, you mentioned that Chris felt that like it was so important to have the kids, and it felt like they were this missing part. And I love the structure of the film. It has this really tight structure where you're moving between kids and then the workshop workers. So did it, I guess, you know, why was that structure, that approach so important? And how did that shape filming?
Well, you know, what was interesting, sometimes you're working on projects where like there's a really tight deadline where you're like, you know, and you guys probably know this is like when you're working on stories where you're just like, the deadline is the driver, right? And it's like, as the creative person, you're almost subservient to the deadline. We had the incredible benefit, as I said, we started this project in 2019, to really let this evolve in the way that was best for the film. And so Nick Wright, who's our amazing editor on the project, you know, he did so many different, like, and it's amazing, you know, sometimes you see a finished product, but to see all the different stages that it goes in. So like the order of the repair people, I cannot tell you guys how many debates were had, like who should be first, who should be last, who should go here, you know? And then there was like, is this four short documentaries? Like, should each of these be their own short documentary? And so there was just so many back and forths for those particular conversations. And sometimes like life and creating things, and it just lines up like this, where it just so happened to be that the four strongest voices of the kids aligned with what the repair people did, you know? And like, those are kind of one of those things where you're just, you just kind of thank the film god, whoever put this together. We're just like, you know, just incredible that we had that as a device for the film. And yeah, and just, you know, hats off to Nick Wright, our editor, and Ben and Chris for getting us where the film feels like it just feels right.
I mean, it feels so right. It's so good. And the whole theme of this short is that an instrument isn't just an instrument, right? It can mean so much to the people playing them, whether it's providing opportunities through school or just an escape or something to do that's different. So did you grow up playing an instrument through school? And if not, how did working on this short make you feel about instruments and how they connect with people?
Yeah, I had a very brief musical career. I played the tuba in seventh grade. And I kind of dabbled with the guitar, as like I think all like young boys in the aughts did, but you know, was not really musically gifted. And so for me, like, it really is magic to me. And that's what was so impactful about being in the space when we were recording the score. Chris, who wrote the alum music for the end credits, like wrote that in like a couple days. And then we had, like I said, 60-person orchestra, all these different sections, all the different sections had pieces that needed to be written. These musicians came in having only seen this music for like, I think it was like a day before they had even seen the music. And the conductor brings up the conducting wand, and then like, you're just in awe. You're in awe of like all of these people coming together to create this emotion that you're feeling when you listen to the music. And so, you know, I've always been a lover and appreciator of music, but being able to witness that and seeing how beautiful that is was something I'll always remember.
Listening to Lake Effect, and we just heard a little bit of the song The Alumni from the Oscar-winning short documentary The Last Repair Shop. I'm Lena Tran, joined by Audrey Nowakowski, and we're speaking with the film's producer, Josh Rosenberg. This piece is really incredible because it comes at the end of this beautiful film. We think it's over, but it's like, no, plot twist, here's a really special performance. Also, that's crazy that Chris wrote the score in 2 days.
Yeah, and the crazy thing was, not only did he write that, because obviously he's, you know, co-directing the film with Ben Proudfoot, then they had to figure out, how are we going to film this, right? Because like, the challenge from our standpoint on production was not only did we need to record it, but we needed to film it while we were there too. So it's like, it's just this balance of like giving the room over to the conductor to record the music. And then at a certain point, now it needs to come back to production so we can actually film it, because we had to do all of those things kind of in one day, basically.
Well, so the film comes in under 40 minutes. You worked on the filming for years. You know, we know there's so much that probably didn't make it into the final cut. Is there anything from the workshop or any memories that you really want to share that maybe we didn't get to see?
The big thing was just, we had spoken to so many kids that didn't get into the film. And so like, you know, we really tried to keep all of them updated and informed. And like, we had a big party the day after the Oscars, and a bunch of the kids who, you know, were either very small parts in the film or weren't in it at all were able to participate in that. So it was just trying to like create excitement for them as well, that even though they weren't in the film, they were still part of what we made.
This film is really an example of how many people, how many moving parts it takes to not just make a short, but also with music, with an orchestra, with bringing things together for this one big sound. And we've been talking about the last piece, The Alumni, throughout our chat today. Can you share with us like kind of what you were feeling? I'm sure stress was one of them, but day of, you're producing both the film and the music recording of The Alumni piece. But then how did you feel when you saw it on screen? You know, did you cry like we did when we saw it for the first time?
Oh, yeah. I mean, that honestly, it's like that's always when you know something's really working, when you feel that because like when you're one of the makers of it, you're like so in the weeds of everything that you're doing. And so whenever you're able to rise above that is just like, you know, something's really working. But yeah, you know, on that day, it was just like, it was such a swirl of emotions. There was like, you know, you're always trying to make your day, and there's like always like the stress that's happening. But I always, you know, I've been very fortunate to be on some amazing sets and amazing moments in my career. And I've always tried to take moments to like give yourself a little mental snapshot. And like, you know, like you said, there was like, we had over 100 people that day, and like all these people, it's always the most beautiful thing about being on a film set is like you have this big group of people and they're all collectively using of their time and talents towards a singular purpose. And I've never felt it more than in that moment, you know, whether they were the musicians or, you know, the studio staff at Warner Brothers or, you know, my production team, everybody was working towards this purpose. It's so hard to describe, but it is just like this like electricity that you feel when you have that many people all trying to accomplish the same task.
That's awesome. And so, of course, your efforts were recognized. You guys won the Oscar for Best Documentary Short. What was your Oscars experience like?
It was really surreal. You know, it's like I had never been to the Oscars before. As a company, Breakwater Studios, we won the Oscar a few years ago for The Queen of Basketball. You know, but it was like, it's just so surreal. You know, it was like a kid growing up having like watched the Oscars and, you know, being a big fan of movies and the Oscars. What I was so struck by was we were able to be there with the repair folks from the film, and then also Porsche and Ismarai, who are two of the students, were there. And again, it's like what we love to do here at Breakwater is illuminate people who haven't been given their due. You know, if you look back over the films that we've made over the last several years, we keep coming back to that because it's such an important thing that we can do to honor work that someone does, and oftentimes honor work that people do in the shadows. And so being there on the red carpet and like holding the Oscar and like seeing the look on their faces is just something that I'll always remember, certainly more than like any like celebrity sighting or like, you know, anything like that, which is, you know, it's fun, but just like seeing how seen they all were and how appreciated they were. And they were all in their tuxes and their dresses and they all looked like $1 million was just like such an incredible moment that I'll always remember.
Well, Josh, we want to thank you so much for joining us to talk a bit more about The Last Repair Shop. We loved it so much, and I'm so grateful that we got to learn more about it from you.
Yeah, and in closing, I just want to say if like anyone saw the film and they were inspired by it, we are launching a $15 million capital campaign to make sure that The Last Repair Shop never goes away here in LAUSD. You can go to thelastrepairshop.com And our goal is, like, let's have this in Milwaukee. Let's have this in Chicago. Like, we want, like, our hope is that, like, we can make this so successful here in Los Angeles that it can grow to other parts of the country. And, you know, obviously as a Wisconsin person, I would love to see that spread to my home state.
Josh Rosenberg is the EVP of production at Breakwater Studios and producer of the Oscar-winning short film, The Last Repair Shop. He joined Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski and WUWM's Lena Tran last year. You can watch the film on Disney+. And that wraps up today's show. Thank you so much for being here with us. I'm Joy Powers. If you missed any of Lake Effect this week, you can find all of our conversations at WUWM.com. If you'd like to take the show on the go, you can download the Lake Effect podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Tomorrow on Lake Effect, we'll learn about Milwaukee's Silent Book Club. And thank you so much for joining us right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.